The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
The downtown east side remains particularly hard hit during the COVID-19 pandemic. Kat Norris is a Coast Salish elder from Liaxin First Nation, and Michael Harris, who is Gitsan. Both of them are volunteers with the annual Fry Bread giveaway in the downtown east side, which happened on Sunday yesterday and reached hundreds of people. We talked to Harris and Norris about their efforts and why they participate in the Fry Bread giveaway. And also, Kat explains why she's been knitting ribbon skirts to give away after an incident elsewhere in Canada where a student was told to wear formal clothes to their classroom grad, but was told their Indigenous traditional ribbon skirt was unacceptable. Here's Kat Norris. How are you doing, Kat?
I'm doing good.
Well, it's great to have you back on The Pulse here on Co-op Radio. So one of the things that I think everyone is really focused on this year is Indigenous rights and what can be done to advance them. And I know this whole discussion about the ribbon skirts kind of exploded this year and last year. Could you explain it to us? What happened with the schools and the ribbon skirts?
Yeah, what happened is with a lot of schools, they don't... Or they frown upon Indigenous people wearing their cultural regalia for their graduations, including post-secondary. And a little girl, it was the last day of school, and all the kids were asked to wear something formal. So her family put together a beautiful ribbon skirt for her to wear. But it wasn't the teacher, but a teacher's aide who made her feel bad because she wore something formal. And so made her feel really bad because they worked hard. It's not easy to make a ribbon skirt, It's not the hardest thing in the world, but you have to pick up colors, go shopping for the ribbon, getting it on straight. Even I struggle with getting it right. And so she told her family, who were very upset, of course, and put it on Facebook, and Facebook blew up. Because a lot of us were told the same thing over time. And historically, after contact, in business or forms, it became against the law for us to wear our regalia, to gather together in ceremony, to practice our culture, sing our songs. What also was against the law, we're breaking the law if we start a business, starting to become independent. With that history, in our hearts, when we heard about this happening in the modern day, it was very upsetting to us.
Could you explain the importance of the ribbon skirt? What is a ribbon skirt? Where would you wear it?
Well, the ribbon skirt today, it's quite a modern thing. But it's become a traditional, because we've always been an adaptable people. Like I said previously, you can't wear like a cedar-made skirt or a top, or we can't wear hide skirts like we do at powwows. You can't wear that every day. It's not functional. And it's also very expensive. So the ribbon skirt is a more economical way for us to show that we are Indigenous, but also show our pride in our culture. And so the ribbons, mean different things to different people. For tree-spirited, they now use the rainbow color. And if you support the LGBTQ people, I can't say it right. We're showing support for them by wearing rainbow colored ribbons. And depends on which culture you come from. The colors mean different things to different nations. Basically, it's a show of pride that we're not afraid to show our culture. And for some have said that it's like a coat of armor, a protection for us. And in showing our pride so boldly, no one can say anything about it. No one can put us down for it.
So tell me a little bit about how people reacted to this incident and why are so many people now making ribbon skirts, including yourself?
Well, because it's something that shouldn't happen in today's day. It was quite a shock that this is still happening in 2020, especially with all the what's happening down in the United States, all the racism and blatant racism and Trump coming into power. Yeah, it shouldn't happen today. We should be more compassionate. With COVID happening, we should be more compassionate. But obviously the, you know, the teacher's aide was very uncomplimentary of what she was wearing. So we had to take a stand for ourselves, you know, stand up with this girl. Because with residential school and the reservation system, it took away our support for each other. So, you know, in standing up for her and showing our support, you know, it's our show of activism. Wearing our ribbon shirts now has become a form of activism.
So this weekend you actually held an event around this, right?
Yes, I did. I organized a rally at Gravity Park.
Tell me about the rally.
It's become a show of activism. You know, that we are wearing our ribbon skirts and ribbon shirts, and now a lot of our people are saying is that it's something that we should wear, you know, daily, not just wait for ceremony. Because some only wear it for ceremony. Their ribbon shirts. Some only wear it for powwow. But now it's going to become everyday use, just in support of the little girl and all students who are told that they can't wear their cultural regalia at school or for public function.
We have such a long history here in BC with the pen and the potlatch and on the dances and regalia here. I think this hits a nerve with so many people, regardless of which nation they're from.
It's something that, as Jewish people, we have not lost our culture, the longhouse culture. And so we're very fortunate that our leaders, Pastor Day and others, went underground for everything since you knew this, but not a lot of other cultures had that, you know, opportunity to continue to practice their culture.
Was there anything at the rally that kind of stuck out to you that someone said, anything that happened that really, really moved you?
I think just that so many men showed up in their ribbon shirts as well as women wearing their ribbon skirts. So it was very, maybe quite emotional, because we often, you know, don't think about our men as well. So that was very touching to me, that there were people of all ages, from babies to elders, that showed up. And a good mixture of men and women.
Kat, could you tell us about that other event that you've been doing for years, the fry bread giveaway?
Yeah, another event I'm really proud of. This is our 13th year, and the event started because of number one, Frank Paul. I rallied for Frank Paul for 10 years, and one year a passerby yelled out at us, you know, why are you rallying now? You know, where were you before he died? Why weren't you there before? Why didn't you help him before he died? Why are you whining now?
Now, could you remind us about Frank Paul? I know he was killed after being dropped by police, right, a few years ago?
Yeah, Frank Paul was a mixed-bag man who moved to Vancouver to find a better life, but due to the situation and the loss of his partner, he began to drink, and he moved into Vancouver and eventually downtown Eastside. He was someone who had arthritis. He could barely walk. He had a hard time using his hands. And we saw on the news, like everyone else, him being dragged unconscious across the, you know, police lobby into the freight elevator. I was very upset, and I called Union BC Indian Chiefs, United Native Nations. I even called the Métis organization to ask if anyone was going to be doing anything. And each one said, no, we're not going to be doing anything, or whatever. It was negative. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do something. So I organized a rally. And that was probably the biggest rally, besides the Ask No More, the biggest rally I've ever organized. Mm. Yeah. People were there in their regalia. Chiefs were there. Just so many people felt the same way, you know, but I just happened to know how to bring the people together. So I gave them a venue to voice their feelings.
And so over then, you've been doing the fry bread giveaway in memory of Frank and kind of all those incidences of police abuse, I guess.
Yeah, he was the big impetus. But the second impetus was heading to the AA dance one New Year's Eve. And instead of going over the Second Narrows, he went downtown to the Lionsgate So we had to go to Rainy Hastings from my place. And we could hear right at Main and Hastings, as soon as we got to the neighborhood, you know, guys walking by our car yelled, Happy New Year! And so we start honking, Happy New Year! And people are just yelling, Happy New Year! To each other, and that really made me emotional, because they have nothing. You know, and here we are all dressed up, makeup on, our hair did, and, you know, money in our pockets, and we're going to go have fun. So, you know, that made me, you know, want to do something. So I think it was the next day that I made a big pot of fry bread and brought it down. They were so grateful. And then I did it again, but I called my friends and community, whoever wants to help out. And, yeah, I think the first one was probably the biggest one ever. And I utilized the media. So we had people from all backgrounds, communities, families, non-Indigenous, from the Asian community, dropping off socks and bags of hand-knitted items and cookies that they got together to make. And that I knew I was doing something right. Because I find that, like, people credit me with what I do, but I have the idea, and I'm just doing something that so many people want to do, but they don't have the ability or the contacts.
People can kind of climb on board once they hear about it. It's kind of like your face mask sewing when you got a huge group of volunteers as a result of just starting something.
You just start it and people will come.
I suppose it's not hard to get people to enjoy fry bread either.
Oh, yeah. And to my friend's credit, no one even takes one until we have a whole bunch done and then it's time for a little break and then they'll enjoy a piece of fry bread. And then we always let each volunteer, you know, take some home.
Tell me about it. How did it go?
It was perfect. We had quite a few different volunteers, and we had one main cook, and that's what he does. His name is Jeff Deere. He works at the Aboriginal front door, and he was the perfect choice. You know, we got everything together. We did the shopping yesterday. We did the thing they let us use the setup yesterday. So we mixed all the dry ingredients, and then we came in today and we just started cooking.
How many people did you have helping out?
About 20 people in and out of here over the day, but about 40 people altogether. Yeah, we rotated, and we had a lot of my friends donate financially. And so this is all volunteer driven.
Mm.
My volunteers, you know, we had volunteer drivers and they drove everything downtown and handed out the fry bread and soup. Downtown.
What were some of the reactions to getting fry bread? It was such a cold and rainy day.
Oh, I know. I'll have to let Michael tell you what was your reaction, Michael, to the people getting fry bread.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, Michael Harris from the Good Time Nation here.
Tell me how today went.
Well, it was really an exciting event. I've been involved with this for many years in different ways. This year, I spent the whole day here in support, picked up Kat, and we started right from the beginning of the day. And there's a lot of variables happened throughout the day. You know, we had the bannock making, and we did some actual baking. Most of it was fry bread, which is two different kind of products. And then, of course, we picked up chicken a couple of days ago, and we made a couple of great big pots of chicken soup.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Which is good on a big, rainy, cold day like today.
It was beautiful. We're down here at the center, Britannia Center, and a beautiful facility here for them to donate to us. You know, the whole thing is volunteer, of course, and donations. And so we had people come down here, and we were doing the COVID distancing thing, and, you know, everything was covered, and we had lots of different sanitizer products here and masks and screens and whatnot. And so, you know, people came in, put in some hours, and they'd leave. Other people would come in. And so it all worked out really, really well. And then we had Britannia also has a couple programs here right on the site where they're looking after shut-ins. People can't leave their homes too much. So a lot of the bannock went out there and went actually to people's residences.
Mm, that's great because so many people are isolated right now.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of a new thing. We haven't done that before, so I'm glad to see that happen.
Have you been part of this before, the bake-off?
Oh, yeah, yeah, quite a few years.
Why do you volunteer? What's in it for you?
The Creator guides us to help our fellow women and fellow men, you know. And I know for myself, I've been blessed with essential services captain. I work in the tugboats. And so I haven't missed a paycheck through this whole COVID-19 thing. And so, you know, I'm able to wrap up some of my donations, but also my time as well. I have time off from the tugs. And so, you know, we work through the day doing the stuff, and we plan, there's meetings before, and then, of course, there's always a meeting afterwards. And then when we finally get to the point where we're going to go downtown, east side, right down to Skid Road, and there's the Vancouver, the Aboriginal Friendship Center, and it's right at Main and Hastings, kind of the epicenter of downtown. And so we go down there and pull up in about 3 or 4 vehicles, and it's loaded up with boxes and boxes and boxes of fry bread and soup, already put into containers, you know, plastic spoons and whatnot, and pull it, open the Aboriginal front door and pull out some tables right onto the sidewalk that's running south and north. And then people are very well aware when people are going to feed them, they naturally line up. They're really respectful. You know, I kind of lift up my hands to the people downtown, east side street people or whoever. They're always really respectful and always say thank you. You know, and sometimes they can hardly believe what we're giving them, right?
What is it about giving out bannock that means so much to people? I know that you said your Gitson, I know it's more popular out eastern Canada to have bannock, but what does it mean to you? Did you grow up with it?
Yes, yeah. I think most First Nations in some form had fry bread. You know, when I was a child, we didn't have electricity or running water or anything like that. And I remember any bread we got, you know, my granny, auntie, my mom made it and taught us how to make it too. And I can remember my mom making the bread and she would cut some stuff off and make fry bread. We didn't call it fry bread back then. She used to call it buckskin bread. It was the same thing.
Huh, that's amazing.
I think in some fashion every nation probably had that. And so it's endearing to us. And then, of course, we had some bologna here too, and that's bologna, when I was a kid, it was like one of our staples, especially when we get away from the reserve where you're not getting fresh meat all the time, like wild fresh meat. And you have to buy it, you know, if you say you're into a city like Terrace or Prince George or something, you end up having to go to the store. And so money was really tight when we were back in the 50s and 60s. And so bologna was one of our staples. And I remember as a kid thinking I'd never... eat bologna when I got to be an adult. You know, sometimes you just got to go buy some bologna, right?
You definitely do.
Happy moments, you know, when you're a kid or your body just craves it, you know. And so for today, you know, we had some bologna and we made up sandwiches, you know, cut the fry bread in half and put some bologna in between.
And with those things combined with the chicken soup, it must have just been such an offering of comfort food to people on a cold day.
You know, we had the table set up and people lined up right away and they're just so thankful. And then because we had so many and we didn't want to be there forever, some of the guys started grabbing the boxes of fry bread, heading down, handing them out. And we had 2 bannock in each lunch bag, you know, little brown paper bags. And then Sister Jenner and I, we grabbed a big basket full of the soup, and they were in, you know, contained little containers, and about a cup full, I guess, per container and a plastic spoon. So we kind of followed the 2 guys who were handing out the bannock and asking people if they want soup. And, you know, walking down Hastings, you know, in the rain, you know, people would be standing there forever, I guess, you know, but we just came out of the building and you're walking down the street in the rain and offering up hot soup, panic. You know, they're just so, so thankful, you know, and they're so polite. And, you know, generally after we got gifted away all the soup, we're heading back towards Aboriginal front door. And, you know, I commented to her, you know, they're always so thankful and polite. You know, even I recall, you know, being at an event, there'd be a whole bunch of food left over and I said, yeah, throw it in the back of my truck. And my driver down Skid Row, pull over the side of the road, park the truck, pull back the tailgate and pull the boxes forward and immediately a line would form. And there's no budging, there's no swearing. And if someone happens to say a poor word, they'll always apologize to us, right? It's really, really respectful. It was explained to me one time there was a lady, I think she was under the influence, and she ended up kind of coming down on another person that was with me. And so another man that was bigger jumped right in and made the lady back off. And you know, the lady took off, so he chased after her, let her know that that was not acceptable. And then he came back, and he apologized to the other person that was listening. And the other person was saying, no, it's okay. And he goes, no, it's not okay. You know, we really depend on donations down here. You know, money is really tight, and we don't always eat every day. And so when someone, out of the graces of their heart, comes down here and gifts us food, we want you to come back. You know, we're not polite to you. We're not respectful to you. You're not going to come back, and then we're really going to suffer. So we won't put up with anybody disrespecting you. She goes, well, you're a really good man. He goes, no, I'm not. Because if you knew me, you wouldn't like me. But, you know, we have rules down here that people have to abide by. And that's the truth. I've seen rules down there, and street rules are tough. You step outside the rules, people will let you know right in the hurry. You're not doing that.
Indeed. My last question for you, Michael, before we go back to Kat, is just, you know, this time in the COVID, this last year has been really, really tough, especially for Indigenous folks in the Downtown East Side. I know a lot come from the territories like yours, Gitxsan, or from out east, or from Coast Salish Nations, but a lot of people, for whatever reason, have ended up in the neighborhood struggling through with so much resilience. Is there any message you have that you've learned from people in the neighborhood or that you'd like to share in this difficult time?
You know, a lot of the people, they stay within a stated area if they're Downtown East Side. And, you know, so there's not a lot of transference. People kind of stay in their 6-block radius, and they don't generally step outside that too much. So there's not a lot of movement between the 6 blocks. And then a lot of people who don't live in Downtown East Side, they stay away from there, it seems like, you know, or they'll drive their car right through. So they don't stop and interact with the people down there. So the, you know, the chance of COVID-19 spreading down there is fairly slim. You know, it was many, many months, you know, probably a good 7 or 8 months into the COVID-19 before I even heard the very first case in Downtown East Side in Vancouver. And it was one person. They immediately isolated that person. And a lot of people down there, they respect each other's space by not, you know, going out. And, yeah, they look after each other. They know who belongs where. If someone isn't all of a sudden around for a period of time, they recognize that person's out there, and they'll miss them, and they'll start searching for them or going to the police and asking them to try and find them. Or you'll see it on Facebook, you know, this person has been around for 4 or 5 days, and that's not real down there, right? So I got a lot of respect for the people down there. They're very nice people. Nobody woke, you know, was born or woke up one morning and said, that's where I wanted to live. You know, for whatever reason, they end up down there, but they're doing the best they can, you know. And I know a lot of us, we support different societies or agencies or outreach programs that are going there, and that's what I do. You know, I picked urban saves lives, right? Culture saves lives, you know. So I go down there and I make my donations there. There's many other societies. I've supported urban societies all over the place, and other people have too. And that's something that should be mentioned too, is that because of COVID-19, a lot of people have lost their jobs or their jobs have been reduced. So they've lost some income. And that immediately starts cutting down on their expenditures. And I know families have to look after their children and their mom and dad and everything else first. And, you know, and all of a sudden you get rid of money. The donations to the outreach services drop off, you know. And so I really encourage people who have an extra couple of bucks, you know, to make a donation of some kind or make a pot of soup and take it down there and gift it to one of the societies. You don't have to go down and interact with the people on the street yourself. You know, you can get a hold of these different societies, outreach programs, and say, what can I bring and when can I bring it? And they look after disbursement, you know. So it's safe, you know. Because I know that people have said to me, Mike, you got to be really safe. And I said, that's the safest place in the world down there.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Michael, and for also for contributing.
And I just would like to end with that, you know, it's a very humbling experience. And I remain humble when I'm doing that. You know, First Nations, we always work in the circle like the medicine wheel. And so nobody's above each other or below each other. You know, we're all even. You know, we're in a circle. And you know, but by the grace of God, our creator, maybe that goes us, you know, walking down the street there, right? So we never look down at anybody down there. We're just helping each other out to make the best we can with what's going on.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Michael.
Bless you.
Kat, thank you so much. That was great. Yeah, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners about how they can help in similar ways, or what you'd like to see in the year ahead in the Downtown East Side?
Yeah, all it takes, you know, if you have an idea, just go for it. You know, and call your friends and family together. And so many people want to do the same thing. It just takes one person to use their voice and come up with an idea, bring a few people together.
And do you have any advice or thoughts or words of wisdom to share with Indigenous residents of this neighborhood, the Downtown East Side, that in this difficult time? I know the COVID and the unemployment has just reached kind of crisis proportions, and the overdose epidemic. What would you say to folks, Indigenous folks in this neighborhood, trying to get by this year?
Yeah, I think we're all struggling in different ways, you know, and we've all gone through big struggles. You know, we're struggling to make ends meet. And then all, you know, but we just lived on hope, you know, and being creative. And I learned how to make hair bone pipe chokers. I learned how to make that. And make things to sell. I used to sell fry bread, make a few dollars, you know. You have to get creative. That's what our people are. But sometimes it's forgotten, you know, because the government made it against the law for us to be independent, because it was even against the law to start up a business, you know, when we were on the reservation. So it's a big part of why our people are just catching up to society, you know, in terms of starting up their businesses. And I want to get to that place where it's not such a big deal when one of our people, you know, start their own business. It should be commonplace, but it's not, because of the government's stance against our people. You know, it's ongoing genocide towards our people, whether people choose to believe it or not. So there's always hope.
If people want to donate to your efforts, Kat, with the fry bread or other initiatives you're doing, is there a place they can transfer money to?
Oh, yeah. We used up every bit of donation this time. And I'm very, very thankful for the help, you know. And so the email is just very simply katnorris@hotmail.com.
Well, I really appreciate it, Kat, and I wish you all the best in 2021.
Thank you so much.
Take good care. Bye-bye. And that was Kat Norris, founder of the annual Downtown Eastside Fry Bread Giveaway. Kat is a Coast Salish elder from Liaxin First Nation and has Musqueam ancestors as well. And in that interview, we also heard from Michael Harris of Gitxsan Nation.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.